All right, well, it's a couple minutes past the top of the hour. I think we've got a lot of folks online already, so we're going to go ahead and get started. So welcome, everyone, to this conflict-free leadership call, the last in a three-year series hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of our Unbranded Doctor Project under the auspices of the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education Grant. I am Rachel DeGolia, facilitator for this call and a board member of the NPA. In my day job, I direct UCAM, the Universal Healthcare Action Network. So for the past 3 years, the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education has worked to decrease the influence of pharmaceutical marketing on doctors' practices and to improve policies at U.S. medical schools and teaching hospitals. Make no small plans. I think we've made some progress. Since tonight is the last call in this for this three-year project, we decided to handle things a little differently than our usual agendas. Rather than have longer presentations, we have asked the four partners for this project to each take a couple minutes to briefly outline some of the newest tools and best practices standards they and their organizations have developed to address conflict of interest with regard to pharmaceutical marketing, and then we're going to go right to you, to all of you on this call, for your questions and observations to make up the bulk of the hour we have together. And we want to make sure you come away from this call with a really good idea of what's out there to help you address this issue wherever you work or wherever you study. And we also hope we can stimulate a little brainstorming around new ideas for advancing this work. So at this time, I'm going to ask everyone to mute your lines, press star 6, or you can use your phone's mute button so we can all hear better. And then you can unmute your line and be ready to jump in as soon as we've heard opening remarks from each of our presenters. So we have four speakers representing the four partners for the PACME project. We're going to start with Sally Ann Berg, who is Senior Associate at the Pew Charitable Trust, who's going to tell us about Pew's prescription project. And I'm going to, Sally Ann, if you don't mind, I'm going to state your email so people may correspond with you after the call readily, if they wish, which is S-Berg, B-E-R-G-H, at Pew Trust, that's P-E-W-T-R-U-S-T-S.org. Sally Ann, tell us about the prescription project in a couple minutes.
Great. Thanks, Rachel. Nice to be here with everyone. Like Rachel said, my name is Sally Ann, and over the last 3 years, Pew has been collaborating with the other three partner organizations that you're going to hear from. We've been working on this grant from the Attorney General Consumer and Prescriber Education Grant Program. It's quite a mouthful, but we're very grateful for the funding. And the overall aim, as Rachel already stated, is to improve conflict of interest policies at your institutions across the country. We've made some great progress. A few of the things that Pew's been working on over the last few years, I'm just going to outline really briefly, and we can certainly open that up to questions later. But at the very beginning of the project, Pew was instrumental in working with an expert task force of leaders from academic medical institutions. This group met in D.C. a number of times and via the telephone, and we created a set of 16 best practices to eliminate or reduce conflicts of interest at academic medical centers. The full report can be found on our website, which is embedded in one of the links that you received in tonight's reminder email. So in addition to those 16 best practices, we worked very closely with AMSA to update their annual scorecard. The best practices from the expert task force very much helped to inform the updates that we wanted to do for the scorecard. And I'm sure most of you on the call know that the scorecard is an annual tool that basically grades conflict of interest policies at your institutions. So part of the grant was that we would refine and strengthen that scoring methodology and also expand the tool to teaching hospitals across the country, which had never been done before. So we worked really hard to kind of beef up, raise the bar a little bit on what was out there already, and in addition to helping to strengthen that scoring methodology, I had the privilege to serve as a scoring analyst for the 2014 release of both the medical schools and teaching hospital scorecards that came out in June and September, respectively. So if you have any questions at all on why your institution received a certain grade, I can answer any specific questions. There's lots of nuances to how these policies get graded, so certainly feel free to use me as a resource to that end. And currently, as we, you know, have released the grades of these COI policies, I'm also working really closely with Community Catalyst. We're providing some additional technical assistance to a number of institutions, basically to help them improve their conflict of interest policies. And, of course, at the end of the day, everyone wants to get that great A on the scorecard, so helping them to fine-tune little areas where they might peak that perfect score. And something coming soon that we're working on is going to be a widget of sorts, which will sort of be an online badge that any of your institutions that did receive an A on the scorecard can put on your website, and it will just kind of be one of those a new U.S. News and World Report type of thing where you can brag a little bit about getting really top-notch scores on your policies. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to you, Rachel.
All right, and again, Sally Ann's email is sberg, S-B-E-R-G-H, at pewtrust, pewtrust.org. All right, so since Sally Ann talked about AMSA and the scorecard, let me introduce next the second partner who's going to give us a very brief presentation, partner for the Pathway Project, Brittany Kessler, who is National President of the American Medical Student Association, to tell us about not only a little more perhaps about the Scorecard Project, but also AMSA's Just Medicine Project. And Brittany's email is pres@amsa.org. Brittany?
Well, thank you so much for the introduction. I'm very excited to be on the call tonight and to represent AMSA. We have actually been working on the scorecard since 2007. The American Medical Student Association released our first scorecard in 2007, and then in 2008 we worked with the Pew Prescription Project, which was the initiative of the Pew Charitable Trust, to develop an updated scorecard, which we have used consistently since 2008. The 2014 AMSA scorecard, as was previously mentioned, we have updated the scorecard. As before, we had general medical schools, but this year we have had 204 U.S. teaching hospitals that we've added. This year, I'm happy to announce, we've had roughly 17% receive A's, 54% B's, 15% C's and 13% incomplete. And the methodology around this is very stringent. And if anyone has any questions again on what determines each score per category, I'm happy to go into it, although it is a little complex. But we were very excited just to be able to add these teaching hospitals. I can say that, you know, medical students and future residents really do want to make sure that their education, their medical education, is conflict of interest free. This is just something that's very important to us. We want to be able to trust that the education that we are receiving is of the best practices. So, again, we're very excited to be able to do this and to have this scorecard out. And the Just Medicine campaign in general just works on that conflict of interest free medical education. We have a whole team that works on this, that really does advocacy around conflict of interest-free education, and we have a whole team of students whose real job it is to work on this throughout the year. So I will keep it, you know, brief tonight. If anyone has any questions, I'm more than happy to answer them. Please go to www.amsascorecard.org to actually see the scorecard itself. And on the website, it goes a little bit deeper into the methodologies and how we really got to these specific scores for all of these different institutions. I know the team has worked very, very hard over the summer to get this scorecard out, and I'm very excited to be able to share it again with all of you tonight.
All right. Thanks, Brittany. And again, that's Prez, P-R-E-S, at AMFA.org if you want to get in touch with Brittany directly. Okay. Third, Jean Silver Eisenstadt, Executive Director of the National Physicians Alliance, a third partner on the PathMe project, to tell us about MPA's unbranded doctor and integrity in medicine work and what some of the new resources, what resources are that MPA has to offer. Jean?
Thanks, Rachel. Well, the Unbranded Doctor campaign really was the signature founding campaign of the NPA, and we are approaching our 10th anniversary next year. So when the organization was founded, this was a core driving concern and commitment of the initial group, that we needed a multi-specialty medical organization that was focused on patient-centered advocacy and free of these conflicts of interest with the drug and device companies, made us practically unique. That commitment to avoiding conflict of interest grew out of the values that our founders had developed through AMHSA. So the NPA is in many ways born of AMHSA. It was founded by past presidents of the American Medical Student Association. So we've been working on these issues for many years, and the last 3 years, it was a very natural partnership among these four grantee collaborators here on this this PACNIP grant, because we've been working really in parallel and in conversation prior to the last 3 years. The NPA's piece of this particular grant work has been focused around leadership development and creating a different culture within medicine. I mean, there are certain things that the government can do that are regulatory, and there are certain things that, that drug companies can be held accountable for, but there's a whole lot of change that, that really involves physicians cleaning up our own house. And part of that is the way that training happens, cleaning up practices and sort of unspoken, the tacit curriculum at medical schools. A lot has to do with clinical habits, acceptance of gifts and perks, and the industry-sponsored CME when there are other alternatives, and just taking responsibility of getting more educated around the cost of these conflicts for patients and what can happen, the role of conflict of interest, even at the level of the FDA, is another area of our work that has grown out of this, these other projects. So the new resources that we have to offer include, this is all archived on our website. If you go to our homepage, npalliance.org, there's many ways to navigate to this bulk of work, but if you just type PACME, PACME, which is for the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, PACME in the search box, that page will include links to all of the things we're talking about on the call tonight from all of the partners. And again, the NPA's contribution to this particular package is a series of National Grand Rounds presentations that will webcast on a range of topics related to conflict of interest, and also leadership development call series, of which this call is the final in the series. So there are 19 calls, there are 10 NGRs, a number of those do also CME, and the topics that we covered were very, very broad, things about everything ranging from the open payments website to how you approach curriculum development at medical schools, to the AMHSA scorecard, to conflict of interest that affect clinical guidelines. I won't read them all to you. They're all on the website. But these are helpful if you wanted to create a journal club model. Maybe we can brainstorm later about ways to use these recordings to start conversations in your own workplaces and schools.
All right. Thank you, Jean. And Jean's email is Jean, J-E-A-N, at npalliance.org. All right, last but not least, Wells Wilkinson, who is staff attorney and senior policy analyst for the fourth partner in the PACNE project, Community Catalyst. And he's going to tell us about some of the toolkits that Catalyst, Community Catalyst has, as well as the Conflict of Interest Policy Guide for medical schools and academic medical centers, which I believe is fairly new.
Oh, thank you, Rachel. Yes. So, as you mentioned, I'm the staff attorney and senior policy analyst with Community Catalyst. That's a national consumer advocacy group. And for the last 8 years or so, we've been working with Pew and then for a little less time at MPA and AMSA on trying to promote change within the medical profession and its institutions to try to address conflicts of interest. And we do this on behalf of consumers because we see the exceptional amount of financial waste in our healthcare system that's really driven by aggressive drug industry marketing and of expensive brand name drugs primarily. And, you know, this amounts to probably more than we're spending right now to expand insurance coverage under Obamacare, just to give you some perspective. So one piece of this work that we've been doing recently is to write, as you mentioned, these toolkits or policy guides for leaders like all the folks on the call here from NPA. And each one of these guides addresses a specific kind of conflict of interest policy that we feel should be in place and why. And this is the second generation of these different toolkits that are now complete. There are about 10 of these documents. And each one explores the rationale for these new conflict of interest policy standards that we think are have evolved and should be in place right now, as well as rationale for each of them, arguments for and against them, and finally some kind of model policies that are actually already in place in different medical schools or teaching hospitals across the country. And, you know, one way for folks to try to use these is to decide, you know, after they pick an area where they want to try to improve their hospital or medical school policies because they thought, for instance, in the AMSA scorecard that they got a low mark, you can turn to one of these guides and kind of look at it to kind of understand and bone up on the background, if you find the policy, and to try to understand the arguments for and against it. And you know, take this information to any meeting you might have with leadership or a discussion you might have with your colleagues to consider taking up this issue as something you should change. So I'd love to talk a little bit more about some experiences we've had with some of the schools that we think are kind of ripe for change right now, but I want to open the conversation up to your membership first. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Wells. You know, the reception on your line is a little in and out. I don't know if you want to try dialing in or move to another room if you're on your cell. It might be a little bit better. So, I don't know. It's a little shaky. Wells' email is W. Wilkinson, W-I-L-K-E-N-S-O-N, correct, Wells? I spelled it right, with an E?
It's exactly without the E, yeah.
You say, tell us your email so you get it right.
Sure. It's W. Wilkinson, W-I-L-K-I-N-S-O-N, at communitycatalyst.org.
All right, great. And it is a little shaky still, your reception there. I don't know if you can fix it a little bit. Please know, as Gene said, that all the partners have posted links to the resources mentioned on tonight's call on the NPA website at npalliance.org, and you can put in PACME, P-A-C-M-E, in the search box to find them. And before I throw it open to everyone, I do want to acknowledge Ann Wollison, who is the Education Director for the National Physician Alliance and put together the agendas and the speakers for all of these calls over the past 3 years, and she's just done a terrific job. And I'm not sure, Anne, if you want to say a few words here tonight, but I wanted to invite you to do so and just acknowledge what a great job you've done.
Well, thanks, Rachel. You've been great, too. Thanks, everybody, for being on the call tonight and for participating. I don't want to hold up the conversation, but there's a tremendous amount of opportunity with access to healthcare expanding now and into the future. But I hope you'll keep these tools in mind and think about other opportunities, as well as implementation of the open payment system, for example, that many of you have worked on over the last 3 years. So thank you, and we'll let out some questions to folks and see what might be helpful.
All right, great. So we have a really great mix of medical students and faculty and practicing physicians from all across the country on the call tonight. Folks, I welcome you to unmute your lines now to to share with us any questions or comments you have, either both, and I invite not only the panelists to respond, but anybody else on the call who might like to respond, because a lot of folks who participate in these calls have a great deal of expertise. And I'm going to just start it off with a question that really I would love to hear a few responses to, which is, what's motivated you to join this call tonight? Were there some experiences you had with conflict of interest where you work or where you study that led you to feel that you wanted to participate in these calls and in this project? I'd love to hear if anybody would like to respond to that right now. And again, to unmute, if you muted before, you need to press star 6 again.
This is Brittany. I can go ahead and just give kind of a brief...
Sure. And introduce yourself, please. Give us your name, where you're from, and your institution.
Sure. So this is Brittany Kessler again, the president of the American Medical Student Association. And I know that conflict of interest-free education is very important to me, especially because when you're in your third and fourth years of medical school, you are very exposed to industry and the influences of industry. So I know that when I was actually on one of my general surgery rotations, I was basically kind of made to go to at least one industry-sponsored event. And I wasn't a fan of the fact that I had to go to this event for, you know, in order to kind of be accepted within the rotation. And the fact that this dinner was sponsored by industry just made me feel uncomfortable, and I don't feel like medical students should have to do these types of events in order to be successful on their rotation. So that's kind of my own personal experience with it, but one of the reasons I find it so important.
All right, thanks, Brittany. Anybody else? Or anybody else have another question or comment for any of our speakers tonight?
Hi, this is Richard Bruno.
Rachel,
Say where you're from so everyone else knows.
So I'm a resident in Baltimore, but when I was in medical school in Oregon, in medical school we had, so a second year of medical school, we had a lecture about this particular medication called eculizumab, which is one of the more expensive medications available. It's for a rare disorder called paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. And at the end of the lecture, I asked the lecturer, I raised my hand and said, you know, can you give us a sense for why this medication is so expensive? And she actually said, well, you know, actually I was, you know, principal investigator on, you know, the studies that were done on this medication. And, you know, this is after she's given us, you know, why this medication, you know, is great for this disorder and all this stuff. And a lot of us were a little chafed by that. She never sort of disclosed up front that she was actually, you know, heavily involved with, the research that sort of brought this, medication to market. And, we actually ended up, using a lot of the AMSA farm-free, scorecard, efforts to, bring new policy to our medical school that any, lecturer of any medical students at our school should include a second slide in their lecture set, a slide set, to say, you know, disclose any type of information or ties to industry. So that's now in the policy at our med school.
Hmm. All right. Thanks, Richard. Any other questions, any comments from any of the panelists? Questions for the panelists?
This is Jean. Just to respond to Richard's little story, the topic of disclosure is really interesting. It's something that NPA supported and that we have helped champion in pushing for the Sunshine Act, you know, components of the Affordable Care Act, which now enables, the website's not fully populated with data yet. It just has, you know, a limited subset of payments from industry to physicians for the last 5 months of 2013. So it'll be a while till we really, you know, have a full data set. But it enables people to look up individual doctors and see, you know, whether they've been paid by companies and how much and for what purpose. And that transparency is going to be very helpful, maybe in discouraging people from accepting these gifts, because it does raise a lot of questions, but also in just, you know, for policymakers and researchers to see the extent of these practices and be able to then, you know, look at how they relate to prescribing practices. But there, you know, Sharon Levine was one of the speakers on one of our previous calls, and she's out at Kaiser in Northern California. And she made the point that oftentimes disclosure is, you know, people treat it as, you know, sort of a triumphant endpoint. Well, now we know. Well, you know, and just think it's important to emphasize that even as helpful as it is to have the second slide, that with the disclosures as something that's now sort of expected and common practice and culturally responsible, it doesn't eliminate the conflict of interest at all. And sometimes it can have sort of a perverse consequence of heightening trust in the in the audience and the listeners. Well, this person, you know, they told me what their deal was. You know, they're honest about it, so I'm more inclined to trust. So I think we're going to have to watch and see how disclosure works, and it's an area that I think could be interesting for future work that we could do now that we're going to have more information than we ever had before about payments that are flowing.
Okay. Any reactions to what Jean just said, or further questions or comments?
This is Steve Smith. I don't have anything more to add to what Jean said. I think she's right on target there. Disclosure is a necessary but not sufficient part of conflict of interest management. But what I did want to say is Wells and Sally Ann and I and Marcia have been involved in providing technical assistance to medical schools on their policies as a result of the New Hampshire scorecard that's been a little bit more sort of anti-grade inflation. And I just want to say how powerful a factor that AMSA scorecard has been in getting schools' attention. I know that the grant is ending and some of the support that has been helpful in the last few years is not going to be there anymore, but I hope in whatever way it takes that the scorecard continue, because it is such a powerful drive for schools to pay attention to that. And the reason is, you know, every dean was at one time or another a medical student and wants an A. So it's definitely something that we ought to keep going one way or another. So Brittany, I hope you take that into account.
So this is Brittany, just to quickly respond. We are, I can tell you on our end at AMSA, although we don't have the explicit grant funding, we're trying very hard to hopefully at some point secure additional funding, but we are doing our best to work with pretty much a zero budget base. But we're very committed to ensuring, you know, the continuation of the scorecard and the success of it, just because it's made such an impact. So we hope we're going to do our best.
Oh, that's great. All right. Anybody else? I'd be interested in hearing a little more about what obstacles folks have encountered in trying to get their institution or practice or clinic to adopt stronger conflict of interest policies. Do people have anything you can share in regard to that? I'd be very interested to hear, and I think others would too. If not that topic, how about what's some of the biggest challenges? Oh, go ahead.
This is Jean. I mean, I'm not in practice myself, but I hear a lot of vignettes from other folks in the NPA, and I know that one of them, on the practice front, one of the challenges that may not be front of mind for folks is the pushback that folks get from their front desk staff when, you know, you have a culture or a habit of, you know, coffee and donuts in the morning from the drug reps, or, you know, lots of food samples floating around, or, you know, they always bring pizza on Fridays, these kinds of things. It's very hard. I know some cases the docs have handled that by, you know, reaching in their own pocket to buy lunch for their staff once a week, just so that there's not that sense of loss. And, you know, and you know, I, even in my husband's practice, they've, you know, have a policy of not allowing the drug reps to come and drop stuff off, and yet somehow these folks still find a way to just, you know, sort of, where did this stuff come from, and nobody's quite sure how it got into the snack room. It's kind of surprising how the food's a big factor for folks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is Sally, and I would just echo what Jean said, and, you know, just from the conversations that I've had with institutions and talking about their policies, you know, it seems to, there's certain trending areas within the domain that we score on the scorecard where there are a lot more difficult areas to implement than others. So I would, you know, institutions that are kind of just getting off the ground, start with your dean, start with the leadership, have those conversations, and, you know, start with the low-hanging fruit, the areas that you know are going to be very accessible, and then kind of slowly over time start digging into the harder areas. Because a lot of times it's really the way in which you message the policy. You can frame things that don't necessarily sound, you can make things sound more positive than faculty may think they are. So things like, I'm just thinking of a particular example, not allowing your faculty to go to promotional events. You know, a lot of times we hear, well, that's, we can't control that. That's freedom, you know, that's their right to do what they want. We can't control that. But, you know, if you frame it in such a way, your faculty, they're there to educate students. They're not there to promote and market a product. So I think it's just, you know, looking carefully at how you portray the issue. And I think over time, as Anne mentioned, too, with open payments, we're going to start seeing some trends, and certain areas are just going to become more commonplace.
Maybe somebody should say a word about open payments, because I'm not sure if everybody on the call will be that familiar with it. What is that, and how is that likely to impact things? Any of the panelists?
This is Jean again. For folks who are interested in real, you know, detail about it, one of our national grand rounds did have a guest speaker from CMS speaking about open payments. So there's a whole hour talk on it. But the short version is that, you know, if you just type in openpayments.gov, you know, you'll come to a website that enables you to search by name, by hospital, or by individual prescriber. The data reporting is an obligation placed by the government on industry. So physicians don't have to report the payments they've received, but the drug companies have to report by name the payments that they've made. So, again, this is incomplete data, you know, at this point, but by June of next year, I believe it should have, a full year's data to share. And, you know, I don't have it at my fingertips right here, but, I mean, it's a shocking number of hospitals, of teaching hospitals, and a proportion of physicians in this country are in that database already, even though it's only reporting from the last 5 months. It's the majority of physicians are in that database in terms of numbers.
So I get the sense that there's been a lot. We've made a lot of moves in a good direction, quite a bit in the last few years during the duration of this project, but there's still a heck of a long way to go. I think the introduction of this call said that 59% of physicians in this country last year, in the last 6 months of the last year, took payments from pharmaceutical companies one way or another, and that's a pretty shocking statistic, I think. So,
Rachel, this is Steve. I wanted to get back to, this is sort of a segue back to an earlier question you had about what are some of the obstacles, and today when we were talking to one of the medical schools providing technical assistance, one of the obstacles that they faced in having robust conflict of interest policies was, well, how do we enforce it on our volunteer faculty? So we were talking about sort of extending the policies out to clinical voluntary faculty, especially in terms of, you know, attending these promotional events sponsored by drug companies. And up till now, there really isn't a particularly good way to enforce that. But with the open payments website available, that question really becomes moot, because it's going to be fairly easy for a medical school to be able to know if their faculty have been feasting at the drug company trough, if you will. I know I just recently checked my own personal doctor and found a few meals payments there on the open payment website, so it is working, and I think it's a great resource. And I think it will overcome one of those obstacles, which is the reluctance on the part of medical schools to be too tough about their policies in terms of community-based physicians, because they have to recruit those physicians to help teach their students. But this would be a solution to the
I did find the numbers there. It was more than 500,000 individual doctors are in that database in those 5 months. CMS reported it was $3.5 billion paid out, and that was almost 1,400 teaching hospitals received payments. So it really does identify a problem that we have to keep working on.
This is Marcia Hams from Community Catalyst. Hi. One other thing I wanted to mention that we have also produced as part of the grant is a survey instrument that a medical school or teaching hospital can use to measure how effective their written policies are, because one of the problems still, even though we've been able to rate the written policies, the institution may not know how well they're being followed, and also, which is part of the information they need to know for further education or enforcement, and also understand the perception of the policies by their staff and others covered by them. So we've developed a standard instrument and are just completing a piloting in three institutions, and we'll be publishing a paper with the instrument on that by the end of the grant. And so that's something that if you're working with in your institution with leadership and on the process of improving policies, it's a tool that the institution can use in evaluating themselves in order to figure out next steps.
Okay. Any other questions or comments or ideas for future work in this area from folks on the call? So I have a question to any of the panelists here. Now that the project is winding down, how do folks stay abreast of the new tools and developments in this area as your organizations develop them? Is there a list of folks ought to be signed up for? Is being on the MPA list enough? Are there others? Panelist or
I'll just chime in. This is Sally Ann. The email that went out to everyone this evening is a great resource, because there are lots of links. So I am assuming all of our links to the different schools and materials and archives of meetings and events will all be up there, you know, for a long time, and we encourage folks to just go back and, you know, use those resources. And even though, you know, some of us are not maybe working as fully on these issues as others moving forward, you know, we're all still going to be around, and, you know, or, you know, I speak for myself here as well, we're happy to, you know, be resources to anyone that has specific questions on particular pieces of the work, and, you know, we want to be as helpful as possible.
Okay.
And Community Catalyst will continue to keep the tools that we develop on our website, and hopefully we'll, you know, as Sally Ann said, all the links with the various partners will be publicizing one another's work as well on a continuing basis.
This is Jean. Certainly staying on the, you know, NPA list, we will keep our, you know, it doesn't cost anything to add your name to our list, and we do add things out. But if you type unbrandeddoctor.org, that will point you at our site and also to a page where you can add your name to our Unbranded Doctor Network. Doing that will sort of identify you in our database as someone with special interest in these issues, so that when we do, you know, sometimes when things go out that are maybe more nuanced or maybe particular advocacy opportunities around this stuff, that we don't necessarily hit the whole list with that information, but we will hit anybody who signed up through that page. So join our Unbranded Doctor Network.
Alrighty. So, what are some of the things that people who are mentoring medical students can do? What kind of advice is there for AMSA to help students address conflicts of interest situations which they continue to confront? I think a number of people on this call work with medical students as faculty or in other ways as mentors. Would anyone like to comment on that?
This is Steve again. I was just thinking before the call began about my own experience. I work at a community health center in my hometown, and I have a medical student from the University of Connecticut who comes sees me one afternoon a week, would be tomorrow afternoon, in fact. I couldn't remember ever hearing from UConn about their conflict of interest policies and, you know, whether it applied to me as a community-based physician, voluntary physician. And I recently had a chance to ask them, and they said, oh, yeah, it's on the Blackboard site, you know, which is this teaching learning environment site that no one pays any attention to whatsoever. The answer was, yeah, I'm supposed to adhere to their policies, but you could have fooled me about that. But since I've been involved with this faculty project, I certainly brought it up with the medical student. We've had a very interesting discussion about it. Certainly every day in practice, there are opportunities to talk about one of the various aspects. I think going back to what Marshall was saying about that tool, the survey tool, I think the survey tool could be used to better assess the attitudes of community-based faculty about conflict of interest policy. I think there's a misperception on some of the administrative leadership at medical schools that they really don't want to touch this area because all community-based faculty must be eating free lunches and getting pharmaceutical samples and other bad things. And I personally don't think that's the case at all. I think faculty are more like me and most of the NPA docs that I know. We teach because we like to teach, and we teach because we think we have some values that we want to instill in the students. And I would bet that many, if not most, of the docs who are out there volunteering to be teachers believe very much in the importance of professionalism. And I think giving that survey, using that survey for voluntary faculty could confirm that. I think medical students ought to agitate more about having their medical schools be more assertive about reaching out to the faculty that are teaching the students and talk about the importance of professionalism and how conflict of interest is a great springboard to broader issues of professionalism as a point of discussion in those teaching sessions.
I think that's a great point, Steve. This is Marcia. And I just say that, you know, even with the preliminary data from the pilot site, in many cases, the adjuncts were not actually surveyed in the pilot site, but that certainly could be done. And in terms of the perceptions of the policies by faculty at this point, they're finding that each pilot site's finding that there's, you know, very widespread support for the policies. Now, they vary, that instruments can be used for schools with different policies, but they're generally in the same generally reasonably good in these in the pilot size B's and A's, and for the most part, somewhere around 80% or more of faculty basically are satisfied with the policies. A small number are, I think that they're too restrictive, and a small number think that they're not restrictive enough. So that's really important information for a compliance committee or COI committee, people that are championing these policies, to know that, because sometimes they hear from the people that are opposed to the policies, and they don't know what the general feeling is about them.
This is Jean. I would also add just to your question about you know, mentoring medical students, and I'd say that medical students often feel very powerless and don't appreciate the power that they have and what an incredible force for change the student voice can be, and how students can grab the headlines with very small actions and can change culture with just a little bit of consistent pressure and questioning. I mean, I think when students are shopping around at different residency programs and trying to learn what the residency programs are like, that questions about their policies are important ones to ask. If students start asking that and that starts to become a metric by which programs are evaluated by their customers, you know, they pay more attention to that. And I think that in institutions that have had the courage to lead on this, that it very quickly becomes a point of pride for the organization to be a leader. And, you know, there's always going to be some people who are worried that the sky's going to fall and that people are, you know, making drama where they don't need to, and this is how we do it. And there are a lot of, there are a few voices that will be resistant, but I think, you know, people want to be able to trust the journals they read. They want to be able to trust the teachers that are in the front of the lecture hall. They want best evidence, and they want to be prescribing treatments that are shown to be safe and effective. And that discovering that you've been caught up in settings that are confusing a bunch of ad spin with good data is an incredibly uncomfortable place to find yourself as somebody with the responsibility for other people's lives in your hands. So I would just encourage students to not be shy about asking these questions, because they're some of the best things that you can do for your patients in the long term.
Okay. Thank you. So I just want to invite anybody, any of the panelists, if there's any you know, concluding remarks any of you would like to make here, or questions that you want to throw out there for folks to think about as we move into the next stage of work in this area, now's the time.
I just as well. So I'll just follow up with Jean just mentioned.
Oh, well, you're breaking up. Can you try moving to another room or something?
Yeah, I can try.
Try again.
So one thing we did, we had kind of seen, is that it's good for medical students to do their best to raise these issues and try to speak up. We've also found that when talking to compliance leaders at different institutions, we found that there's a lot of vocal people who are dissatisfied with the restrictions that conflict of interest policies may place. But they don't hear as often from the people who support these policies or who think that they should be strong. So that there's kind of a silent majority of people out there. And I think it would be a good idea for proponents of stronger conflict of interest protections to try to do their best to be constructive and be vocal about engaging with their institutions on supporting the policies and even improving them. One thing we've seen recently is that AS's scorecard has really helped, you know, kind of focus people's attention on specific areas where their school or their hospital may be, you know, not keeping up with the best practices trends that other schools are adopting. And I think it's been very helpful to try to move institutions to address some of these complementary improvements. And I think the time is right to do that right now, with both the payment disclosures and creating broader public attention on conflicts of interest, and also with you know, the fact that a lot of schools have had their policies in place for 3 or 4 years, and through the general cycle, they want to kind of reevaluate them, potentially improve them every several years. So this is a good time to start raising these issues.
So speak up if you really, if you, when in your support for strong conflict of interest, and revisit, make sure your institution revisits them periodically, because they are getting stronger over time. And we are, the best practices keep evolving. I think that's what I'm hearing Will say. Anybody else among any of the other speakers like to chime in here?
Sure, this is Sally Ann. I would just echo echo what Will said, and also as we have expanded the scorecard to teaching hospitals or to a subset of the teaching hospitals, I think it's really important that medical schools and teaching hospital compliance folks start having those conversations with one another, especially if they have differing policies. A lot of times they're closely affiliated and they share policies or there's a lot of overlap, but sometimes they are really like night and day. So, you know, the spectrum of policies out there amidst teaching hospitals that have affiliates and those that don't, or if they're part of a larger health system, I just think it's really important that the whole academic and clinical environment is linked in some way through these policies. So this is really a great opportunity for institutions to have those conversations amidst their peers and just begin having those critical look at what's being put out there for their faculty and students.
Okay. So it has certainly been a great pleasure for me to have had the opportunity to facilitate these calls for the past 3 years. I can't tell you how much I've learned from doing it, and I have immense respect for the work that all our presenters and the participants on these calls are doing in this really critically important yet very difficult endeavor to reduce conflicts of interest in medicine. And it's at a time when corporate influence in medicine has only increased. So I know we have a lot more work to do, but it's so encouraging to see and to hear and to see the results of the work that's going on. What I'd like to do at this point, we're coming close to the end of the hour, is I would like to ask Jean Silver-Eisenstadt from NPA to kind of wrap things up for us tonight and remind everyone that we will have written notes as well as the audio for this call posted on the NPA website shortly. We don't have any more calls to announce at this time, but I'm sure NPA will be continuing to do grand rounds and other ways to continue to share some of these issues. But I'd like to ask Jean to kind of wrap things up for us.
Thanks, Rachel. I really don't have a lot more to add to what you just said. This has been a tremendous 3 years of productive work with some fantastic partners. Community Catalyst, the Pew Charitable Trust, American Medical Student Association have been phenomenal to work with, and each of these groups has generated a lot of complex, you know, not complex, but a lot of rich resources. So this call was sort of a big picture of the organizations and the fact that all these things are out there, but I would encourage folks who are interested in this topic to just spend a little time digging on the website to see, because it's the kind of thing where you address any piece of it, any one domain, ask any one question, and you're making a difference. You're starting to change the culture, so it's not imperative to learn the whole landscape before you start asking the questions. And there's all of us are very accessible and friendly and responsive people, and you have our emails, and we would love to brainstorm further with you and think about ways to grow and expand this work in the future. And I just want to thank everybody for being a part of it, and Rachel for facilitating, and Anne for helping to coordinate, and for everyone who's joined tonight.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. I'm sure we'll all be in touch. And carry on. All right? Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thank you, everyone.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.